don't you tell me a little bit about your involvement with Occupy?
Started last fall, I guess. I went to a meeting of the Occupy Brooklyn Arts and Culture, met some people there. I said, I have an old play of mine that might be of interest to you. I'd actually started it. Let me do a little more backstory. I'm a longtime playwright. I write about people who get in trouble, specifically people like the Plowshares Movement, people like Carl Cabot, people like the Berrigan Brothers. And the play I had was something that we had been touring around when I still had a company during the Iraq War, which was, how do you change things? You know, how do you change things through nonviolent civil disobedience? And the title of the play was, How to Stop the Empire While Keeping Your Day Job. And it was out of that that I performed at the first big protest in Brooklyn, which was November of last year. The people involved in that were interested, so I kept doing the play. I did it at Judson for Occupy the Empty Space. And it was videotaped at Judson, and it's now on a whole lot of Occupy websites. So Occupy Los Angeles and San Francisco, and I get emails from Occupy Las Vegas and places like that. My continued involvement in it, in the Occupy movement, has been towards the cultural side. What I think of in terms of being effective protest, I lean towards the side that you need a bigger cohort of people who, if not on your side, are at least relatively neutral about what's going on with Occupy. What I say to people is that I understand why the 20-somethings are in Zuccotti. What I don't understand is why their parents aren't there. Because their parents are going through the same kinds of things in a different way. Their parents don't have pension money. They're watching their kids struggle. They're being told that whatever happens with Medicare and Social Security, it's going to be less than what their own parents had. So how I see myself in Occupy is as someone who reaches out to a generation that's more in my age cohort.
And you use stories to reach this population. Can you talk about how stories through your career as a playwright and an actor have helped you with this population?
Well, for over 10 years we were touring a play that I eventually did for Brooklyn for Peace called A Clown, a Hammer, a Bomb, and God. And what I wanted to do, I wanted to talk about the Plowshares Movement, the people who nonviolently disarm nuclear weapons as what they see as a religious act, you know, following the biblical exhortation of Isaiah to turn swords into plowshares. Now, do I think that somebody who's watching that particular play, which has been done 200 times in the United States and Europe, do I think somebody is going to go out there and do one of these protests? Actually, someone did, but they were pre-motivated to do this. What changes, though, is not that brave activist doing that act. It's that the activist is in front of a jury of his peers who suddenly understand what he's doing. That if you change public opinion about Occupy, then maybe some of the action starts to make more sense to people. There's a context. I have a blog called Move for Change in the Brooklyn Culture Jam, and one of the things that has occurred to me in recent weeks, Occupy is still waiting for its Bull Connor moment. For people who aren't old enough, Bull Connor was the sheriff in Selma, Alabama, who turned fire hoses on nonviolent protesters. And it was that scene, that videotape that was splashed all over American TV for weeks on end that changed a lot of people's opinions where they could no longer sit on the sidelines regarding the civil rights movement. In fact, purportedly, after John F. Kennedy saw that film, that videotape from Selma, he decided it was time to do a Civil Rights Act. And that's the Civil Rights Act of 1963. So what I see artists is doing is making sure that people know what's going on. You know, you don't have to agree with the kids who are camping out. You don't have to agree with having a drum circle in your neighborhood to understand that there are some things about the economic status quo that need to be changed. And it isn't just changed because the 99% are on the losing end. It needs to be changed because the planet can't support the status quo. You cannot have an economy that keeps growing, keeps using more energy, keeps pumping out more carbon dioxide. And if you don't make that available to people in a way, that information available to people in a way that they can kind of connect the dots themselves, I don't think you can succeed in what a movement is trying to do.
So you're not really looking to even change people from sidelines into occupiers in a park. You're trying to create this kind of a culture of solidarity with activists?
I have some really good friends who've been arrested for civil disobedience against nuclear weapons in Europe. If they had been arrested in the United States for what they had done, they would have served heavy-duty prison time. And there was a lecture that I attended once because I wanted to understand this. It was by a Belgian human rights lawyer. And he explained that things in Europe had gotten to the point where the government couldn't put heavy charges on people for civil disobedience against NATO and nuclear weapons because they could never get a jury that would convict. So if you look at Occupy as a movement, and I should back up and say that caveat that I just made, if you do something violent, the jury is going against you. So I'm not an advocate for violence in any way. But if you get to a point where the jury system will no longer automatically return a conviction, where the judicial system can no longer count on the obeisance, if you will, of the judges, the sitting judges, then things change. It's sort of like if every single person who was arrested on the Brooklyn Bridge, instead of being negotiated down, I mean, there's a fight right now over the arrests on the Brooklyn Bridge, but if every single person in that arrest had the confidence that they could say, nope, I want a jury trial. The judicial system is not set up for 700 trials. They are not set up to put 700 people on trial. It's kind of a way of playing chess. You know, at some point, if the judiciary loses the respect of the people of this country, then things can start to change, I think.
Is that a process? Is that known as jury nullification?
Jury nullification is this great thing. William Penn is jury nullification. One of the founding fathers not talked about. But yes, in the American judicial system, this dates back to the colonies, you are allowed to vote your conscience regardless of the evidence you are presented with. It was how the Quakers kept from going to prison for not worshiping in the Church of England. And that has been true forever. There's an organization called the Fully Informed Jury Association, which actually will send you leaflets and flyers that explain your rights as a juror. But people don't hear that. When an acquaintance of mine was put on trial for temporarily disabling the nuclear weapons targeting system, she wanted to present evidence that she felt would show that this was a first strike weapon. This was not defense. This was about the United States taking an imperial role in the world. And because of a motion in limine, which keeps her from, keeps her defense from introducing things that are considered not pertinent to the trial, she wasn't able to do that. And she said, after that, that what she was going to fight for in her life was that people understand jury nullification. And that especially people who are progressives, people of conscience, should actually try to be on juries.
Can you explain jury nullification?
So let's say, here's a good example. You have a conviction for someone for a rather serious crime, a felony example. And there's no question that the individual, you know, the facts of the case are against the defendant, but the police have also abrogated their responsibility. They violated constitutional rights. They've planted evidence. They have prosecuted one person when it's a fairly reasonable, you know, it's a fairly reasonable assumption to make that there are a whole lot of people doing it, and they've singled this individual out. So juries can vote. You know, you need one person to say, I'm not going to vote to convict. A good example of this, Florida came very close to legalizing marijuana in the late 70s, early 80s. And it wasn't because anybody down there was enthusiastic about marijuana. It's just that they increasingly found it difficult to find juries that would prosecute someone for possession. There was a case in Dixie County, which was one of the major shipping lanes for marijuana into Florida, where the prosecutor looked around, and you have to get the recruits from Dixie County, and he realized everybody who had been seated on his jury was actually someone involved in the drug trade or had family in the drug trade. That's going to be jury nullification. So he knocked the charges, which were for 2,000 pounds of marijuana, down to a misdemeanor time served. That's jury nullification. If, I mean, that's a rather obtuse example, but if you have a case in Occupy, for instance, the cases I'm looking at right now are for the NATO 5. The people in Chicago who were arrested by infiltrators who claimed that they were planning to firebomb Rahm Emanuel's house. And these are five guys from Occupy, actually the three who are facing what are called terror charges. And the argument right now is whether or not they were entrapped. And in fact, there were two Chicago police officers who were taping everybody, who were encouraging them, yes, we should, you know, we should hit Rahm Emanuel's house with Molotov cocktails. That's going to be an interesting case because maybe the defendants went along with this, but it wouldn't have been their idea. And entrapment is becoming an increasing problem. You saw it not only with the NATO 5, you see it in the Fort Dix 4. The Fort Dix, the people who are who were Muslim converts who were convinced that they needed to go attack Fort Dix for Allah, and it turned out that the person who was instigating this was a police informant. As more of these cases come out, if they get spun, if there's jury nullification involved, it will be harder and harder for the government to proceed in actions against organizations like Occupy. And I'm not saying, by the way, that we shouldn't prosecute people who are genuine felons, who are genuinely planning to do these things. I'm saying that it's time for us to think about the idea of people being entrapped and used as a scapegoat, that we've arrested people for living in a park, and now we have cameras set up all over Lower Manhattan that have software for facial recognition loaded. There are all kinds of constitutional issues on that, and nobody has poked those yet. And I think the earlier that we start doing that, the safer everybody's rights are.
So jury nullification seems to be the jury does not respect the authorities. It's not the authorities can't prove what they're claiming. It's that the jury doesn't think it's wrong.
The jury doesn't think it's wrong, or the jury feels that the state has gone about what they're doing in a way that needs to be called out. I mean, everyone picks the OJ trial as the ultimate in jury nullification. That's the one everybody thinks about. And there was some interesting commentary afterwards that perhaps the jury saw no other way to punish the Los Angeles Police Department for what were clearly attempts to plant evidence. And there was testimony presented to them that some of the prime movers in the prosecution's case had been caught at this before. Again, I don't want to get into a debate about OJ. I'm not a big fan. But if the court system, if the judicial system, if the people sitting on a jury find that the state has recklessly gone after someone for a larger political point, yes, jury nullification is one big weapon in a whole slew of weapons that people can use.
I wanted to ask you about, I was reading the points under the Occupy the Empire tour, and one of them was about turn off the internet and the television and meet your neighbors.
Yep.
When did, I don't know the timeline of when you were working on that, but can you talk about that and how Occupy has kind of done the same thing or followed the same idea of needing to meet people to organize and not organize online?
I think that there's been more of it of late. You have Occupy the Empty Space, which is the cultural group, just did a whole series of plays about the immigrant experience down on the Lower East Side in a garden. Occupy has been taking on foreclosures. So they have been meeting with people who are not necessarily part of what you would imagine if there were an Occupy demographic. It obviously needs to happen more, and we need to be back in a place where we were as a group of people in the 1920s and 1930s, where if your neighbor got foreclosed on or kicked out because of rent, you made sure that he could bunk up with you until he could find someplace else to go. In some cases, in fact, city marshals operating for landlords were turned away from buildings even when they had warrants. That's going to be something I'd like to see more of that, but then again, I don't know if it's actually happening a lot out there and we're just not hitting the mainstream. I know that there was an activist group here in New York that was shutting down foreclosure actions here in the city by going to the court and disrupting the court. So that's one thing. In my own experience, I've talked to my neighbors. They aren't necessarily going to be the ones who want to cause problems with the tax man for various reasons. But you have a population in the city that has been bullied about and knows what it's like to be bullied about by officialdom. I live in a neighborhood that's got a very large Muslim population. And in the days immediately after 9/11, my wife and I offered to take people out grocery shopping, because as soon as somebody saw women in the hijab, they were being yelled at on the streets and threatened. Showing solidarity with neighbors is important on these kinds of things. And sometimes, I think, in a movement like Occupy, you lose sight of the fact that maybe the people downstairs are the people you need to talk to. Because, as I say in the play, those are going to be the people who tell you when the FBI is looking for you. And so that's why it's there. You also need to prepare for bad times. If, in a newer version of the play, I talk about People need to get useful skills. And by useful skills, I don't mean they need to learn web coding or financial analysis. I mean, learn how to garden in a small spot of land. Learn how to can. Learn how to preserve food. Learn how to cook when you've got nothing to cook. If all you've got are two cans of creamed corn and $2, and you've got to make a meal for a bunch of people. My grandparents didn't need to read Grapes of Wrath to know how bad the Depression was. And they got very clever about how they made food. And they always had a spare chair at the table. And the joke was that you can have dinner with us as long as you don't ask anything about the meat course. You know, country people, like, you know, it's a porcupine, it's a possum, it's something like that. And somehow they made that edible enough that people could live on it at a time when they had no money. If you talk to futurists, people like the folks at Post Carbon Institute, Richard Heinberg or James Howard Kunstler, we're talking about maybe being at the end of the oil era. We're going to have to live in a whole different way, and it's going to evolve to a time when we have to cooperate with everybody. We've got to figure out better ways to raise our food and to share our food and to become people who are more open to community. James Howard Kunstler has a great line in his book about the end of Easy Energy where he says, "We are now, thanks to Walmart, eating a 5,000-mile Caesar salad. That isn't going to last. You don't have enough diesel on this planet to keep that going. So how are you going to live with a smaller ecological footprint, with less use of energy, things like that, if you don't figure out how to pare things down? And you're going to be requiring help from your neighbors, and your neighbors are going to be requiring your help."
So that's, I mean, that speaks to capitalism atomizing us.
Right.
And the solution of solidarity is really what you're talking about.
Right.
Which, if I'm understanding, after the 20s and 30s, disappeared. In our culture, is that, would you...
Have you ever seen the Noam Chomsky documentary, Manufacturing Consent?
Yes.
Okay, so you know that there was a whole movement in the mid-40s, oh my gosh, we've got all these factories turning out all this stuff, we've got to figure out some way to make people buy more stuff. And so that becomes the whole meme, if you will, if I'm saying that right, about... you know, if you turn 19, you move out and you find your own place. You know, everybody's got their own little house with their own little toasters and their own little appliances. And that's a very extravagant way to live in terms of our footprint on the earth. In a congregate housing building, like the tenements that were around here, you know, you've got 60 families and 5 washing machines. In the suburbs, you've got 60 families and 60 washing machines. Same with the cars, same with everything else.
So do you think that solidarity is an easier thing to do in a city than in a rural place?
I don't know that it's easier to do. Just because we're up against each other all the time, it's, you know, there are going to be problems because you don't have enough arable land in a city to support everybody who's here. So that's going to be an issue, but I think cities are better equipped for a time of expensive energy than certainly are the suburbs. And I also think that there's a mindset about people in the city that they're comfortable with the idea of having to cooperate with neighbors. You know, they know they've got to pull together, that, like, you need one jerk on the F train to pull the cord and nobody gets to work. So I think that whole concept is kind of coming back in the city in a way that it hasn't yet hit in the suburbs. And we're also, though, a much more heterogeneous population than the suburbs. So that has its own sets of strain. My neighborhood is Orthodox, and it's Muslim, and it's, you know, African-American people who are with a Pentecostal bent, or people who are from Jamaica who have their own thing going on. So there's a whole set of cultural, ethnic, and racial issues that have to be overcome, but I think it's possible to do it here. And I think we'll have to do it. And I think one of the things about Occupy that just has to continue is the idea that this is, you know, you can't, as they say, as they said in the old Pogo cartoon, the 99%, them's us. You can't sit on a subway train and you have more in common with everybody sitting on that train, regardless of their background, than you do with the 1%. Than you do with Bloomberg, for instance, or certainly the Koch brothers.
You were talking about food a little bit, and it reminded me of your Monsanto play.
Right.
And it also made me think of applying solidarity to our food and how we get it, how it's made. Can you talk a little bit about your Monsanto play?
Yeah, Good Day to Pie. I like to kid around that that was a play done on a bet, but I was doing it for a friend. What we were doing was a play for a religious group, actually, that wanted to talk about an aspect of Monsanto's grab, you know, biopiracy and the changing of the food and so forth, that, you know, people of faith, food is something you share. You share a bowl of rice. You share whatever you have. And the Monsanto paradigm here is to change that. People don't share Monsanto seeds because you can get sued. People can't reuse Monsanto seeds because they're designed to be used with special kinds of fertilizer and pesticide, glyphosate and Agent Orange now, supposedly with a BT corn. So if we're going to have a shareable world, we're going to have to find different ways to grow our food as well. Current industrial agriculture is that we pour a couple inches of nitrogen-enriched dirt on a pile of cropland we've used for years and years and has never had time to recover. And that's one of the reasons why our food is less nutritious than what our grandparents ate. Now, you can't change that paradigm about the way the food is produced and leave Monsanto in place. And it isn't just Monsanto. Monsanto is one of the big ones, is the biggest one, but they're hardly the only ones that deal with GMOs. So when you talk about a play like A Good Day to Pie, what I was also trying to do, I mean, I was trying to do a polemic about Monsanto and what they've done, because most people don't know. But I was also trying to reinterpret the idea we have about what food is and what provisions are and what our obligations are to each other when it comes to food.
I was thinking about how our stories are co-opted by Hollywood, by big publishers, and particularly by the advertising industry. And I was wondering how you think those stories can be taken back so that we're connecting with audiences about valuable things instead of the, I don't know, sophisticated manipulations of, say, the advertising industry that can really connect with people. Is that because people are starved for stories, or they're starved for nutritious stories? Do you know what I mean?
People love narrative. The thing that I think writers come into this world doing is being able to put a narrative over the top of something that looks like a lot of random action. I mean, praying mantises don't have narrative. Whatever happens, happens. They're fine with it. That's okay. But they don't invent a narrative. human beings have always invented narrative. Now, how do you get your stories away from, I don't know, Steven Spielberg? You need to have a counterweight to Hollywood. You need to have a counterweight to big media. We're falling down on that because I don't think we can talk about. We get very entranced by all the toys. We get very entranced by the CGI graphics and everything else, and we forget that there are stories underneath. One of the things that's saddest to me about the decline of organized religion is whether you like or dislike the point of view of a specific sect or religious order, there's a counter-narrative there. What happens in the last 30, 40, 50 years is that counter-narrative has gone away. The idea of sacrifice and self-service is not what it was. The idea of civics, of a responsibility that we owe each other, is not part of the common narrative. One of the things that's a theme that I keep playing with, and I see it with a lot of lefties, I'm sorry, but it's with a lot of lefties and, you know, old line protesters and everybody else. But you think of the parts in the Christian gospel where people come up to John the Baptist and say, "Are you the one, or do we have to wait for another?" And I think a lot of people on the left get their hearts broken because they think, this is the one. They keep looking for the one. They think this is going to be the movement that makes the change. I think Occupy has that to some degree. I saw a lot of graybeards out on September 17th. And people are looking for, you know, somebody to shout that the emperor has no clothes. And they're hoping that Occupy is actually the ones to do that and doesn't get co-opted, doesn't get bought into an experience, doesn't get... Occupy Illinois just said that they think it's strategic planning for everybody to support Obama. So now everybody in Occupy is like, I don't want any part of Occupy Illinois. So there are narratives being played at all times, and I think our narratives have to change. We have to get smarter about, I guess, what's the figure name? The griot? The person who brings the stories. The person who brings the stories. There's a thing called, you know, verbal literature that we have completely lost any sense of, which is one of the things I'm in love with, is, you know, a one-person show is verbal literature. That's how you tell a story. You don't, you know, I don't, the thing that I like about doing the play How to Stop the Empire while keeping your day job is I just show up. Whatever I'm wearing is fine. Whatever I have in my pockets will work. And that's the story. And I think there's a movement right now that needs to be embraced of how do you get the essential parts of a story? What are the real essential parts of a story? You know, okay, fine, you can have the hoochie coo and the burlesque dancers are making a comeback and so forth, but it's all about story and you don't have story narrative anymore.
So do you think then, I mean, part of that would have to be that audiences are going to seek out lefty storytellers, and that includes lefties too. Instead of going to the Steven Spielberg movie, you seek to support your local media makers or artists.
So, the griot has to be a truth teller. You know, there is, not to trash Steven Spielberg, he's a wonderful person, I hope he gives me money to do the tour, but he's really in love with happy endings. And with endings especially that don't mess too much with your head. I mean, that's kind of generalized and maybe unfair. I also take on, in the clown play, I take on George Lucas. And George Lucas is also someone who talks about narrative and does narrative and Joseph Campbell and all those other good things. We need different stories. We need storytellers who are telling uncomfortable truths. And that sometimes makes people really uncomfortable. I haven't been heckled yet. In the 12 times I've done the play, the Empire play, but I expect that'll be a matter of time. In the 200 times we did the clown play between 1997 and 2005, we never had hecklers. So there is something about, if you can find the right words, you can do it. I don't have another answer than that. I know there are some really capable writers and playwrights and performers in Occupy Movement who can make these stories work and can tell these narratives. The Civilians Project is one of them. But everybody's going to have to find a way to retell stories.
And part of our project is we think of ourselves as collecting the stories of the 99%.
Right.
So I wanted to ask you, do you consider yourself a part of the 99%? And if so, what does it mean to be that?
Yeah, I looked at my paycheck. I'm part of the 99%. There's no question. What does it mean to be part of the 99%? I think it means different things to different people. I think the people who are aware that they're part of the 99%, who have bought into that idea, are probably also looking at a whole slew of other issues about empowerment and being on the bottom. It's one thing to be part of the 99% when nobody's got that language. I think now the language is fixed. Even if you're part of the 47%, you know that you're part of the 47%. I don't think that people are going to be quite so easy to buy off. I think for a very long time after World War II, it was easy enough to buy people off with stuff. You know, okay, you don't have the political rights you really should, but dang it, your Christmas tree is a lot bigger this year than it was last year, and you're getting a four-barrel carburetor on your new Ford Mustang or your, well, probably a Chevy Impala if you had kids. But you're getting, everything's bigger and brighter and everything's going to be better. And even if your work at the factory is miserable and you have to come home and drink Jack Daniels until you can go to sleep, your kids are living in a house that you can pay for. And that narrative held together for a very long time, and it doesn't hold together anymore. So the 99%, I think, are going to be looking at what narrative is the plan B. You know, and I think there's going to be more and more resentment towards the 1%. It's obvious to me when I turn on CNBC that I'm not their demographic. You know, They don't want me in the Chase Preferred plan. They don't want to talk to me about buying a house in West Palm Beach. That's not what they're about. And that kind of celebration of wealth used to be something done on the fly. And I don't think the 1% is smart enough to do that anymore. Or maybe they're just too confident. And I think because of that, I think things are closer to a turning point now than they've been in my adult life, basically. I mean, and I'm somebody, I miss the tail end of Vietnam, but I've been around for a while.